Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Pure Delight, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. You're more than welcome to ring in to the show and make comments or ask questions. There are a number of services available through our organization Toward the Light, and you can find out more about them by visiting our website, towardthelight.org. That also includes near-death studies and support, psychic, spiritual, motivational, and grief counseling, Reiki and remote healing, and other products for body, mind, and spirit. We also would like to encourage you to make a donation, and you can sponsor a show. Again, more information can be seen at towardthelight.org. This week, I'm very pleased to have a fellow near-death experiencer and an author, one who's had two NDEs and who's written a book called My Last Breath. Please welcome to Toward the Light, Mr. Matthew Duvall. Greetings, Matthew.
Hello, Juliet.
It's really wonderful to have you with us today, and I look forward to finding out about your tremendous experiences. It seems like you've been through an awful lot, and feel free to start by sharing. Now, I am right, correct, that you did have two near-death experiences, so feel free to share with our listening audience the events that led up to these experiences.
Okay, first of all, the first near-death experience I had was at the age of 12. And believe it or not, these two moments were the worst two moments of my life. And they're something that every single person on the planet is eventually going to experience. They're what they think will be the last breath anyways.
Right.
Well, anyways, back to the first near-death experience. I was 12. We had my family had no religious upbringing up to this point, so we didn't go to church, basically, and we were just a normal American family, and had an older brother, 4 years older, and we lived in a rural area called Poway, and that's in California outside of San Diego. Basically, I was over at a friend's house, and we were swimming, and 12-year-olds, you know, horseplay, fooling around. I decided I was going to swim the full length of the swimming pool, which I was not a very good swimmer at this time, and still am not. And after this experience, I kind of stay away from swimming pools. But anyways, I swam the length of the pool underwater, and I was going to come up and scare these girls that were there and be the cool guy. And halfway across the pool, I realized that, you know, I needed a breath of air. I wasn't going across the pool quite as quickly as I had imagined in my mind, and I needed air. So as I got to the other end of the pool, I started the surface. And before I could get to the surface, my friends decided to push me back under the water with their feet on my shoulders.
Oh!
And they pushed me down to the, basically to the drain of this pool. And it was a round kidney-shaped pool, so the sides were smooth and round, so there was really nothing to grip onto. And I clawed at the wall to get back to the surface. And by this time, I wasn't even thinking about scaring somebody. I just needed to get a breath of air. And I, just as I was just about to the surface, they pushed me back down again. And their intentions were not to drown me. Their intentions were just to horseplay. And I get to the bottom of the pool again, and I finally came to a stop, and I realized there was no way I could get to the surface with the amount of energy and what I needed. I needed some air in my lungs at this point. And I decided there was only one choice and one option at this point, and that's to breathe in the water. And I knew that this meant my demise, basically. And the moment that I breathed in, took a breath of water into my lungs, I was engulfed by a white light. And, I mean, instantaneously, I went from complete terror into this light that I had complete peace and joy and happiness. And my life flashed before my eyes. I'm 12, so it couldn't have been that big of a flash.
Yes.
That's a joke. Anyways, the light engulfed me. I have this flash. There's a couple of moments in my life that stood out where I was like 5 in the backyard of my parents' house in New York, and we were in its grass, and I'm spinning in the yard with my arms out looking up at the clouds, and it was surreal. Like, I could see the bumblebees and butterflies flying by, and it was just a very beautiful moment. Another one was when we'd go grocery shopping. My mother would always make fried bologna sandwiches for us when we got home, because it was such a long trip for us. And I remembered eating the sandwich and how good it tastes, and the soft, fresh bread. And, you know, and then I go into the light. I remember I'm floating, and I'm like, wow, this is really cool. And I looked down at my left arm, and I could see the light was actually a particle streaming from the origin, and they were actually going into me and permeating my soul. And I was thinking how cool that was, and then I looked back at the light, and there were 12 individuals blocking my path to the light, and all I could see was silhouettes. I couldn't make out who they were. And as I'm kind of figuring out what's going on here, an individual comes from the center of them. And as he gets closer to me, I realize, oh my God, that's Jesus Christ. And, you know, I didn't even know before this experience, I probably heard about Jesus Christ something on TV, but I didn't know him. And as it came out, I knew this was Jesus Christ. I knew this was God. It was something intuitive in me. I can't explain how I knew that, but I knew that I had always known him. And he had blue eyes and this white robe, long hair, and he came to me and grabbed me by the left arm and told me I had to go back. I had work to do. And he didn't say this verbally. He said this telepathy-wise. And as I'm opening my mouth to say no, I'm suddenly back in my body on the side of the pool, and water's coming out of my mouth. As I'm verbally trying to say no, water's coming out. And I guess I'd been down in the bottom for like 10 minutes before my friends realized that I wasn't faking, and they pulled me up and, you know, we're doing CPR, and I came to. And as I'm in my body, I could sense everything about life. I feel like I was being born, basically. I could feel every hair on my body, the wind rustling against me, the sunshine on me. And at that moment, a profound rage came over me, something that I had never experienced before. But I was so angry that I had to come back that I couldn't speak. And I didn't speak for 2 days after that. And at that moment, I got up and ran home, and I was embarrassed, you know, my friends and the girls and all that. I was just, the whole situation was embarrassing to me and humiliating. So, and I never shared about that with anyone for years and years after that. I never told anyone I saw Jesus, and it was in that time and age in the 70s, I would have probably ended up in a rubber room if I had mentioned this.
Oh dear, yes, I certainly understand that, and I've even made note of that in my article about near-death experiences, especially, you know, any time before the past 10 years, there's been a lot more media interest, thank goodness, in near-death and related experiences. But I, too, was very silent, and I had at least 3 NDEs. And it was only recently that I also came out, so I certainly understand that. Now, what was, you know, I would imagine that with drowning and all of that, you were kind of in rough shape, or were you not? Did you just basically bounce right back and you were okay?
Yeah, I bounced right back. I didn't even feel any physical difference as a result of that, but I did feel there was extreme changes that took place in me emotionally and mentally.
Sure.
And there were side effects from the experience, and there were results of the experience that are something that I still struggle with to this day. And like you said, there's been a huge interest in this phenomena, what people call it. I was on Good Morning America Friday morning nationally, and 2020 Friday night. So this is even people who don't believe are like, wow, we want to know what happens when we die. You know, what happens?
Exactly. That's the big question.
And there's a lot of skeptics, and rightly so. But, you know, I've actually talked with so many people who have had this experience. Every one of them have been profoundly changed. Their lives have changed. And for the better.
Yes.
It's not something that, you know, they've had this experience and they think, you know, this is horrible. They think, wow, this is good. I actually know I have a purpose here. And they basically, anyone who doesn't understand the near-death experience basically hasn't had one. If you've had one, you know that it was not some kind of a chemical reaction, your brain trying to protect itself and putting you in some kind of a state like a coma in order to survive. It's ludicrous for anyone who's had the experience to even mention that to them. It was very real, and it was very... the only thing I can describe the white light is it's the total, absolute void of evil.
Yes.
And we're surrounded by evil 24/7 in this plane. And when that's been completely removed, I was so angry I had to come back. I believed this was hell. I truly believed that this was hell we're in, and that I was being punished for some reason. And also I came back with a side effect where I didn't understand. I was 12 years old, little boy. Suddenly I was an adult. I understood, and I could sense and see evil in this world. People who were acting selfishly, and basically when I watched the news, it was horrific to me, the way we treat each other.
Oh, absolutely.
And
one thing I would like to add to your comment, too, because it's really important for people to realize this, you know, as one who's a child and an adult in the ear, the after effects and what we go through as child in the ears, it can take at least up to 30 years to process the experience. So it's very important to be patient with yourself and very compassionate towards yourself, because PMH Atwater, who's done extensive research, as people know, have you know, she's divulged the fact that child NDEs can take at least up to 30 years to process and integrate that experience. As an adult NDE, it will take at least 7 years. My take on that is that it's very accurate, but it also can take an entire lifetime to assimilate all of this, because there are a myriad of layers to the experience to integrate. So you know, you're doing just what you need to be doing, and love yourself through this process.
I don't mean to laugh, but I feel like, you know, this is, I'm 45 now.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like I'm still processing it.
Well, that's why I said what I did just now, because that definitely is going to be the case, especially as this quickening is taking place right now, and we're all becoming deepened spiritually. We're all being made to become more aware. So this is just going to excel things all the more. So go ahead, and I also understand your feelings of rage. I certainly didn't want to come back either. It was the biggest broken heart I have ever experienced, ever.
Yeah, people don't understand that. And I had one of the, you know, this is the part I don't like sharing about, but it's just part of my story.
Just be real, it's fine.
Is that I have this strange ability to see people that are in emotional distress. I can, it's like they have a energy around them, and it's very disturbing to me to see this. I've come to terms with it now, because I still have it, but I can actually feel their emotional state if they're close enough to me, and I try to keep them at a distance, because it actually, I'm like an emotional lightning rod to them, and they discharge on me, and it takes me a few hours to discharge it into, you know, the ground, basically, so that I can move on with my life. But it's one of the things that I had a hard time with in the beginning, and it was very difficult to be in groups, because there was, especially as a teenager, when you experience that in a, you know, because kids are in an intense hormonal state anyway, so to be in a classroom was very difficult for me, and that was until I discovered alcohol, and this blocked that ability, which blocked my influence by God, basically. It blocked that so that I didn't have that gift, and I know now it's a gift.
Yes.
And
good.
So I started drinking because I didn't like that gift at the time, and in the interim I went to a Billy Graham revival in San Diego. This was in the 70s, and they said all you have to do is believe in Jesus Christ, and I'm like, well, heck, I met him, you know, it's not a stretch for me. So I thought, hey, I'm saved, I can do what I want to do now. And I decided, you know what, I'm just going to drink and party. You know, this is hell, so I might as well have a fun time while I'm here. And then when I'm done, I'll go to heaven. And by the time I was 25, I had developed a $1,000-a-week drug habit. And I couldn't stop. And I decided that it would be better if I went back to heaven, so maybe I should just commit suicide, and hey, I'm saved, I'm going to go to heaven anyway, so I'll just kill myself and go to heaven. And that was the basic premise of my second near-death experience. And this one I don't like sharing about, because it makes me very emotional, because it's so horrific, the experience. I was up in Alaska at the time, and I took 3 bottles of sleeping pills and a fifth of gin, went into the wilderness, and took them, and decided I was going to go on to the next life and see God and be in heaven. And as I'm sitting in my car, a flash of light hit me, and I'm out in the middle of this lake by my car, up to my waist, and I'm trying to figure out how I got there. And I noticed that there was no color. Everything was black and white, and the sky moments before was completely blue sky, and now it was cloudy. And as I figure out where I'm at, I look back and I see my car several hundred feet away from where I'm at. I can't figure out for the life of me why I would walk out in the middle of this pond or marshy area and get my pants and shoes wet. And once I figured out where I was at, I had another flash of light, and I was on the road. this highway that was it's a Seward highway. It's a very well traveled road, especially on the weekends when I was doing this. And I'm trying to figure out how I got out of the water and back to this road. And there was no traffic. At one end of the road, there was like a fog going across it. And at the other end of the highway, when I looked down, there was another fog. And there was no traffic. And I looked down at my feet trying to figure out, you know, my pants are wet. I can't walk. What's going on here? A car pulls up next to me, and it's a, this is pretty weird, but it's a New York checker cab, the old-style checker cabs. And they don't have these in Alaska, by the way. It pulls up next to me, and it's dirty. I mean, it's just dirty. There's the windows are all smeared with mud, and the passenger window's down. This guy with a very distorted-looking face, grotesque-looking, kind of gruffy, asked me, "Do you want a ride?" And I didn't even answer him. I just kind of fumbled around and got into the back of the cab, and the partition between us was even so bad I couldn't see down the road. And he took off. And I thought, I just need to rest my eyes for a few minutes because I'm so tired. I just need, I need to rest. And as I close my eyes, there's another flash of light, and I'm free-falling. I'm free-falling into this pit. Pitch black, but I know I'm free-falling, and I know I'm going to die when I hit the bottom of this pit. And it, that's kind of, the irony there is kind of funny. I was just trying to kill myself, and now I'm afraid I'm going to die when I hit the bottom of this pit. But I'm falling. I can actually feel the air rushing by me as I'm falling. Can't see where I'm going, but I know I'm going to hit horrifically at the bottom. As I get to the bottom of the pit, I'm split into seven different of me. I'm able to comprehend all seven of me simultaneously, and that's impossible. You can only comprehend one thing right now at a time in your brain. You can't think of two thoughts simultaneously, much less seven. And two of me, I'm living in my past from childhood on up. Two, I'm living in the present, and two, I'm living in the future. My two past lives, basically, I'm in this place called what I call hell, the real deal. It's very dark, very dense. The ground is clayish. There's steam coming out of the ground. It's very hot, humid. The atmosphere is very dense, so sound doesn't travel very far. About a foot away from you, that's as far as the sound can travel because the air is so heavy. The sky is a boiling mass of clouds with lightning streaks across every few minutes, and you can hear the rumble of thunder from the lightning. And there's pillars of smoke and steam around me that are about 12 feet tall. And every few seconds, somebody'd come out. I believe it was demons masquerading as people I'd met throughout my life. And their face would look and resemble somebody I'd met, like my wife or relatives or somebody like that. But their face was very distorted in some type of an emotional state. And they'd get into my face screaming at me and pushing on me, and I would experience an event that took place where I had caused them emotional pain, and I would feel the emotional pain that I caused them. Now, this was going on in the past, present, and future. In the future, I remember my mother collapsing as she saw my body. She had to identify my body from the suicide. Very horrific, very horrific. The seventh of me was the worst. I was on my hands and knees and on my face, weeping, not crying, weeping, streaming tears down my face, and there was the clouds circling around me, and a light was shining down on me, and I was praying and begging for Jesus to come save me out of here. And this went on for three full days. I could feel the progression of day-night down there. And on the third day, I was drawn up into the one of me weeping, and slowly by the back of my neck pulled up out of this hole, this pit, And a voice talked to me, and it was Jesus again, and he said that I still had work to do, and I couldn't do it if I was drinking or drugging, and that if I continued on the path I was on, I would spend eternity here. And at that moment, my brain or my soul or whatever, I could comprehend what eternity was. And literally, it scared me straight. I came to in a bed. It was over 12 miles away from where I had attempted suicide. It was the next day. A friend was that I had been staying with was screaming right in my face because he had found a suicide note saying I was going to go kill myself, and they had spent the night looking for me. I was unable to even walk or stand up because I had taken sleeping pills and gin, which destroys your nervous system, so I was unable to really function because I had lost my bowel movements. It was pretty bad. I got up and I went to the bathroom, managed to get to the bathroom, fallen down a couple times. As I'm sitting there, I see the steam and smoke coming out of the walls, and I called the fire department, and they came to the house, and there's seven firemen standing there, and they're going, "We don't see any smoke." And I'm thinking at that moment, "Oh my God, there is no smoke," you know. And I told them that it was probably a cigarette that we had let sit around somewhere, and that's what I saw, because they were looking at me like I'm crazy. And as soon as they left, I fell on my knees, and I literally cried for 2 weeks after that, nonstop, thanking God for bringing me back from this place, because I realized this was not something that I dreamed. This was something real, and it happened. This happened on a Friday night, and I thought it was Monday as the progression of time had taken place. And I went to try to go get ready for work, and my friend was like, "What are you doing?" I go, "I got to go to work." And he goes, "No, it's Saturday. You don't go to work till Monday." And I was just at total shock that I had lost 3 days, basically. And from that moment on, I quit drinking and drugging. It literally scared me straight. I realized that I needed to change my life, and I dedicated the last 20 years to helping people get off drugs and alcohol and people who are suicidal, and helping the families in post-suicide work. And I don't know of anyone, as somebody who doesn't believe in God, believe that you know somebody who drinks and drugs and how hard it is for them to quit. You know, they tell you a million times, "I'm quitting. I was a hope-to-die drug addict." And for me to quit a $1,000-a-week drug habit, that's a miracle.
Yes.
It's nothing short of a miracle.
Well, tell us a bit about, and I want to say, too, that's a very, very powerful messages and metaphors that you received in that experience, and that's so much a part of the life review, too. When you do experience how you have impacted others during your sojourn on this plane. So that was really interesting and very powerful to see these people in a sort of distorted state. But I think when anyone is behaving or acting out of fear and anger and rage and that sort of thing, that they, you know, all of us genuinely do become distorted when that happens, and when we are not centered in love. So very, very powerful messages that you received there. So let's talk a little bit about the organization that you founded. It's called International Suicide Prevention, which I really do think is important, because I do get emails all the time from people who are contemplating suicide, and I will lovingly respond to them, encourage them not to, because, and then I'll give the reasons and the information that I've gleaned through my experiences. So let's talk a little bit about that and your websites, too, because I know you've got a website about your book. It's called My Last Breath. So the website is mylastbreath.com, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And then your ISP, as you say in a shorthand, it's supportisp.org, correct?
Yes, that's correct as well.
Okay.
The thing, you know, I wanted to share about this book thing because I never wanted to be an author. It was never something that I had aspired to be. I'm not a writer, so don't expect some type of great literary work. But the thing is, this is amazing to me. This is probably going to sound really weird, but God talks to me. And I don't always listen to him, but he talks to me, and then eventually he gets his way because he starts screaming at me, and I eventually do what he wants me to do. He told me I needed to write this book and share these experiences with others, and I'm like, I ain't going to do that. I'm just a normal guy. I want to stay a normal guy. I just want to have a normal job, have a normal life, and help people kind of, you know, in the backyard type thing. Well, I got to talking, and it's like, okay. He got to screaming at me. I said, look, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write this book, and then, I'm not even going to write the book. I'm just going to write a letter to a publisher and ask them if they want to read this book that I wrote, and that's what it's about. And if they say no, then I don't have to write the book. And the voice shut up, and I was like, okay, that sounds good. So I send the letter out. The next day they write back saying, yeah, send us the manuscript. And I'm like, oh, great, I haven't even written anything about it. So I had to spend the next month writing the book, and every night I would dream about what I was supposed to write the next day. It was the oddest thing. I can't even explain it.
Perfect. Yes, that's wonderful, Matthew. Go ahead.
It's so odd. Like, I read the book today, I'm like, who wrote this? Because I didn't write this. And I send the manuscript to them, and they're like, yeah, we're going to publish it. So great. There are literally, I don't know if anyone really knows this that listens to your show, but there are literally 10,000 books a month being published, if not more. Now, the odds of you getting your book noticed is astronomical. It's astronomical. It's almost like a miracle unless you have a lot of money to push your book. It's astronomical. And if the publisher is behind you, then you could have a successful book. But I didn't have either. I didn't have money. I didn't have a publisher that was going to support me in any way, and still does not. So for me to get put on 2020, a national TV show, a news organization like ABC News, and Good Morning America, all in the same day talking about the story of my book, now that's a miracle. It's nothing short of a miracle. So I just want you to realize that. You know, the story, it's about the story. It's not about the book. So, like I said, don't expect some type of great literary piece of work. It's written very basic and very simple for a reason, because it was meant to touch people who are wondering about the afterlife and still haven't decided to get on a path of their own. So that's what the book is about. It's about getting people to think about the afterlife and what they want to do in this life. Do they want to make a difference? Do they want to make an impact? If somebody like me can come from nowhere and make a difference in this world, anybody can. Anybody can. I mean, that's the real true miracle. And the reason I bring that up is because people ask me, why do I care so much about suicide and people who are suicidal? Because this is the reason why. I do this at lectures I do. I take a $100 bill. Usually it's a dollar because I don't have a $100 bill. So I take a bill and I say, who would like this? It's a brand new bill. And everybody raises their hands. And imagine a $100 bill if you would. And everybody raises their hand, so I take it and I wad it into a ball. And then I kind of smooth it back out. It's looking a little rough now. And I say, who still wants it? And everybody still raises their hand. And then I take it and I put it on the ground and I mush my foot on this $100 bill and make it dirty and tear it a little bit. I say, who still wants it? And everybody still wants it. And I said, this is human life. It, no matter what we've been through, what circumstances, what choices we made that are bad, we still have the same value to somebody as we did when we were brand new, a baby. So you can never give up on a person.
Well, beautiful, beautiful analogy there. That's wonderful what you've shared there. And it's a very powerful point that people do need to remember. Because indeed we were all sent back for a reason, and I was sent back every time to share the fact that life is indeed eternal. We do not cease to be when we leave our bodies behind. And the more of us that are brought forward to share these truths, the more powerful it is going to be for reaching the masses. Because, you know, the fear of death or the fear of the unknown, period, is very unsettling. So when people can start to realize, wow, we really do live forever. It's not just a theory anymore. It is something that people have actually been through that can validate and verify that truth. That's splendid. Well, you know, again, and it seems that lately there's been so much concern about suicide. And I, you know, a comment that I would like to make, I've never tended to judge people, not that I'm a judgmental person anyway, but I've never tended to judge people who take drugs, because there is a lot of pain and anguish and suffering and pressure, etc., that when people are so overcome, they're just going to go towards anything that will provide a sense of relief to them. And the same thing is true with suicide. They feel like, oh, I just can't endure this anymore. I've got to get out. So drugs and suicide are kind of similar, because they are a means of escaping the pain, the anguish, the suffering, and what have you, or so people think. And what I share with people about suicide, and I'd love your input about this, is that it's like dropping out of school or dropping out of class. You can't avoid the lesson. You're always going to have to go back to the beginning of the class and start again if you drop out.
One thing I want to say is that, you know, when I first came back from the suicide attempt, I was very... It was so heavy and impactful on me that I mistakenly started telling people, you kill yourself, you're going to hell.
Mm.
And over time, I've come to realize that that's not for me to decide. That's between God and that person, because I don't know their heart. I don't know their life situation. So I don't say that anymore, because I know for a fact that people who've had suicide attempts and near-death experiences don't always have a hell experience.
Exactly.
So I've come to realize that, you know what, that's between God and them. What I'm focusing on is, if you have a problem, I can tell you some techniques in order to help you through that problem. If you've lost somebody to a suicide, I can help you grieve through that loss. That's my purpose. I know my purpose in life now, and it's to share this message about heaven and hell, and to help those who are having a hard time here. And I know that I have a gift to that. I have a gift of healing, and I don't want to say that like, hey, I don't want to line up my door of people wanting to be healed. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. I know I have an extreme gift that I share with people, but it's a very intimate thing, and I want it to remain that way. One of the things I share with people, if you're having an emotional problem, when you get older, people have a tendency to let the world build up on them. And everybody, every single person on the planet, if they look back over their lives, no matter how tragic or horrific it was, God's given them moments that were beautiful, enduring, and life-changing. And they need to write a list. I call a list of 45 things that make life worth living for. You don't have to have 45 things, but write a list. I'm talking about the feel of a puppy, a birth of a child, a vacation you once took as an adult or a child, a special person that makes you happy when you think about them. You have this list. You carry it around with you all the time. And if you feel yourself in a depressive state, I tell you what, you cannot think of these things unless you have this list.
Mm-hmm.
You pull out this list, and you start thinking about, wow, that vacation I took, that you can start imagining the color of the sky, the water, whatever it was, and it will release endorphins into your brain and cause the depression to go away. And I say these things because I know they're true. Just because I had experienced these things doesn't mean that I don't still have depressions, because I do. And I have my list, and I carry it with me. When I think about some of the moments I've had in my life, that depression is immediately lifted from me, because I know that I have a very blessed life, and I'm very lucky and fortunate to be here today. So that's one of the tricks I have. And the other thing is that everyone from the age of where you can write to you're 100 years old, you should have a goal list. At least 5 things you're working towards in your life. Something positive in your life that makes you want to get up in the morning and work towards them. Even if you're if you're retired, especially, you should have a goal list. I mean, hey, I'm going to walk to the store today instead of drive. That's a goal list. And once you write off one of the goals, you put a new goal on there. I mean, these are things that they don't teach us. And to start eating healthy. Eat healthy. Eat fruits, vegetables. The full diet that they taught us in grade school, we should be eating that way every day. And when we don't feed our body, which is a machine. And that machine needs to be fed clean oil, you know, clean gas. We put dirty stuff in our body, it's not going to run so hot. And that goes for our brain as well.
Well, that's a good point. Now, I want to ask you a question. With your list of joyous experiences that you've had, do you add to it?
I add to it constantly. I take stuff off, put new stuff on. I joke about it, like, you know, if you're on a date with a person and you pull out this list and you scratch something in there and they ask you, what's that? Oh, it's nothing. Come on, what's that list? What is that? Oh, this is a list of 45 things that make life worth living for me. And I just put you on it.
That's lovely. Well, instead of erasing stuff, can you just add to it and maybe it becomes 145?
Absolutely. 45 is just a name of a list. It's not the actual number, because I don't want people stressed out over,
sure,
I don't have 45.
Exactly. And just every day maybe to write a list of things that you are grateful for or that bring you joy, even from that day or whatever comes to mind that you can think of. I think that's a very good idea, to focus on the positive experiences, events, thoughts, encounters in your life, and to write that down. And
sometimes it has to be very, very basic, depending upon the level of depression somebody's in.
Yeah.
They have to get down to, I'm grateful that I have 2 eyes today. I'm grateful I can hear. I'm grateful I can walk. I mean, it's like a gratitude list. I mean,
yes.
If you say, wow, you're not grateful for those things, well, why don't you tie one arm behind your back today and try to do everything that you normally do, and then tell me you're not grateful for having 2 arms.
Exactly. That's a very good point. And I remember, for example, many years ago when I was laid up paralyzed for 1.5 years, when I started to be able to walk again, and even to this day, I marvel at my ability to walk, and I feel such joy and gratitude about it. So we should never take anything for granted and always feel gratitude for it, because it is very special. And little things like holding a hummingbird in your hand, you know, just little things, great things, it doesn't matter. Anything that brings a sense of joy and peace to your mind. That's a wonderful thing to focus on. And also what I do every new moon, which was yesterday, I will write down goals and dreams. And I think it is a good exercise, again, for all of us to focus on what we would like to co-create with Source. Writing down puts more energy and helping to manifest that, to bring it into fruition in our lives. So what you're pointing out here is wonderful. What else would you like to share with us about that? Other things that you know might help people. In fact, I just had Greg Sola on my show last week and the previous week, also a suicide attempt, and he had a near-death-like experience. So this seems to be kind of in the air, and there must be a need to talk about this right now. So go ahead and share with us more, Matthew, about some of the things that you do to help people that are contemplating suicide.
Well, all these things I'm sharing with you are on our website because I feel they're important. There's no secrets. I don't have any, like, great gifts that I, secret gifts that I keep to myself to try to make money or anything like that. I freely give them out. They're available on our website. So one of the things I do recommend is that you get out of the house and walk. Isolation is the worst possible thing for somebody that's depressed.
Or prone
to depression. Another thing is, if you can't get out, bring the outside in. And by this, I mean we practice this. We try to get a bouquet of flowers, spring flowers, not you know like a $30 bouquet or anything, but like $5 or $6 bouquet. Have that on your kitchen table. You'd be amazed at how much joy you can bring by just having fresh flowers in your house every week.
Oh, true story.
It actually, you can smell the fragrance. You feel like you're outside at that point. Limit your TV. Limit the computer use. Try to get outside and interact with other people because you need cognitive interaction. That's where you ask a question, they answer. They ask you a question, you answer. That's cognitive. It creates your brain. It keeps your brain active, basically, and it causes you to watching TV causes depression. Now, I am not against TV, but I think that you need to limit what you watch and try to watch something that's uplifting.
Well, if it were me saying that, I would say just get rid of the television altogether. But that's my take on all that. I don't like television. I haven't got one. I'm pleased to say. I think being creative is really important, like reading, drawing, you know, making something.
Absolutely.
Even if you're not a so-called artist, you know, it doesn't matter. Just do something creative. And
absolutely. That brings us in alignment with what our purpose is. And we all have a purpose, and that's why I encourage you to have a goal list. Because seniors have a very, very high rate of suicide. And it's usually an hour, a year after they retire, because or 2 weeks after they've been diagnosed with a terminal illness, they feel like they don't have a purpose here anymore, and they kill themselves. The irony to that is the book I encourage people to read is A Purpose-Driven Life. You know, I wrote a book, but I'm promoting other books. You know, like read the Bible. You know, that's a good one. But anyways, the purpose-driven life, basically, if you're a senior and you have been diagnosed with a terminal illness, there are people that their whole purpose, their whole existence is to be caretakers and caregivers. They take care of people. Hospice, for example, this is an organization that they basically sit with you your last days of your life. Now, if you kill yourself, you're taking their purpose away. Their purpose for existence is gone. And you have something to share with somebody until you take your last natural breath. I've been with people who've died in their last days and weeks, and they have so much to share. And if they hadn't shared with me, no one would have ever known about them and their experiences in life. And I think that's a tragedy. I think our elderly people are our greatest national treasure. I think they have so much to offer. They have so much life experience they can share with us. And by losing that, we lose our national treasure.
Did you say national or natural?
National, like the United States, our country, our actual existence.
Okay.
I mean, this is national, or international. It's not just a national thing. I just assume we're talking nationally. That's why I said national.
No, actually, we're talking very international. The whole world can hear this, and of course, I'm not American, even though I happen to be sitting on this continent at the moment. But who knows how I'm going to bounce around? It's a really good point too, because you know, when I recently did become retirement age, and I just thought, well, blimey, what the heck is that? I'm certainly not going to retire. And I sort of, you know, I make a joking statement, but I'm really quite serious when I tell people I'm going to be busy until I put my clogs I never plan to retire. I can't really fathom what that is. And I think it is important to be on purpose and being creative, because we do have a lot to share. And I'm writing, I'm reminding myself of a college student right now, 19 instead of in my mid-60s, because I love to read, I love to study, I love to research. Doing the radio show, you know, gaining information and sharing it with others, this is very, very important. So I'm a glutton for information and for wisdom, and I think it's a good thing. When people are feeling really, really sad, I want to encourage them, like you are, to go to a park, do something special for themselves, read a good uplifting book. I can't tell you how much I've been uplifted by when I was feeling really deep anguish and somebody would say, Juliet, check out this book. It would be the right book at the very right moment that would lift me right out of my anguish. So people do need to be open to receiving. That's a big one right there, isn't it?
Yes. See, that's when I did the, I did some research about suicide when I wrote the book, because I wanted to add the information, which I was very ignorant to the fact that over a million people a year commit suicide internationally, around the world. That
wow.
is a, that number is so large.
Staggering.
It is staggering. When you think about the Super Bowl, everybody in the world can think of the Super Bowl football. That stadium times 10, the amount of people that are committing suicide is... It's so grotesque and unbelievable. We should be shouting, hey, you know what? Suicide is a preventable cause of death. This is not something like AIDS, where once you got it, and you're probably going to die from it. This is a preventable cause of death. People, basically, if they know what to look for, and this is something very basic as a human being, you know when your friend or family member has just found their wife with another guy, or they just got fired from a job they had 10 years. These are pretty life-changing events, and maybe I should spend some time with them. Usually the first 48 hours are crucial for these people. Don't leave them alone.
Yes.
And just let them get through the shock part of this so that they don't end up jumping off a bridge or a building somewhere. I mean, this is pretty simple. The actual number actually is more like 2 million, because a lot of the countries don't report the
right.
actual amount of people who commit suicide. And a lot of suicides are misreported, so it's more like 2 million.
Now, do you encourage people to contact you? Let's provide a little bit of contact information so people can contact you. And, of course, I always encourage people to feel free to contact me, too, because I do counseling and I do offer support for people who are contemplating suicide and other issues. But let's get your information out there, love, so that people can contact you.
Well, anyone who goes to my websites can get a hold of me. The phone numbers are pretty, they're easy to get a hold of me.
Okay.
What I do is I refer them to a counselor or more advanced mental health professionals if they need it. I'm basically an ear to them. If they want to just say, hey, this is how I'm feeling, and remain anonymous, they can do that as well. If you are suicidal, call authorities and tell them. You know, somebody cares about you. Somebody will miss you, I guarantee it.
Well, I wouldn't call the police or anything like that, because, you know, the don't want to end up in some kind of mental ward on drugs. That's counterproductive there. That's not going to resolve anything.
It depends upon the level. If you're going to harm yourself, I'd rather you be in a mental hospital where they can address the issue, allow you to be removed from whatever situation it is that you're experiencing to cause you to feel this way. I'm not an advocate of drugs. I'm not. But if somebody's in an extreme state of suicide where they're going to kill themselves or hurt themselves, there is a point where you need to have some temporary medication to allow you to calm yourself down and reevaluate your life, basically. I don't believe in long-term treatment unless you have a mental illness. And there are people who are bipolar that are schizophrenic. If you are those people, you need to stay on the medication that's prescribed to you. And if you're suicidal, you need to ask your psychiatrist to change your medication and tell them, be honest with them about what you're feeling, because they can actually help you. The average general population that's dealing with depression, they just need to know that they need to do the things that I recommended earlier in the show. And you can get those recommendations at mylastbreath.com or supportisp.org.
Well, I really want to thank you for being with us this week for our transmission of Toward the Light, leading back to the source. We do go through the hour very fast. It's no surprise to us here. And thank you very much, Matthew, for being with us. And I want to invite everyone to remember that it is only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please do visit my website once again, towardthelight.org. And I'm always available to help, too. If anybody has had issues or thoughts about suicide, don't hesitate to contact me. My email address is towardthelight@gmail.com. Please remember that only love prevails. We will talk to you next week. Blessings and light to all. Cheerio for now.